I want today to talk about the Industrial Revolution from a variety of aspects. I put everything on the board I put on our website, so don't worry about copying it down, and it's all pretty obvious. So doing the Industrial Revolution across the century is no easy task, but we will do it and do the reading. Let me just say that the way people look at what used to be called the Industrial Revolution, and I guess some people still call it that, has changed dramatically. Through the 1950s and into the 1960s, the idea of the Industrial Revolution was that it was the work of some geniusy inventors who created machines in the used primarily in the textile industry, but also in mining, that eliminated blocks to assembly line production, and then everybody was crowded into factories, and the new brave world opened up. In fact, one of the most interesting books and sort of great classics that's still in print was written by an economic historian at Harvard who's still around, called David Landis, a good book called The Unbound Prometheus, which was basically that. And some of the inventions that I briefly describe in your reading, the spinning jenny, et cetera, refer to that. Well, that kind of analysis led one to concentrate on England, where the Industrial Revolution began, and to view to view industrialization as being a situation of sort of winners and losers by not going as fast. In your reading, I give you some pretty obvious examples of reasons for the Industrial Revolution first coming to England. Location of resources, particularly coal, a country which there's nowhere that's 75%, more than 75 miles away from the sea, precocious canals and roads, banking system, fluidity between classes, a very large and increasingly larger proletariat, agricultural revolution, etc. And with that kind of analysis, those places that didn't industrialize as fast, for example, France, one thought, well, that they were quote-unquote retarded, a word that was used, unfortunately, at that time, and then one tried to see why not. Now, that analysis has been really rejected greatly over the past years, because Industrial Revolution is measured by more than simply large factories with industrial workers and the number of machines. And the more, and this is the point of the beginning of this, the more that we look at the Industrial Revolution, the more that we see that the Industrial Revolution was first and foremost an intensification of forms of production, of kinds of production that were already there. And thus we spend more time looking at, you know, the intensification of artisanal production, craft production, of domestic industry, which we've already mentioned, that is people, mostly women, but also men and children too, working in the countryside, and that that industrial, the rapid rise of industrial production was very much tied to traditional forms of production. In Paris, for example, in 1871, or in 1870, only the average unit of production had only slightly more than seven people in it. So if you only look for big factories and lots of machines, you'll be missing the boat on the Industrial Revolution. Now, to be sure, when we think of the Industrial Revolution, we think of Manchester, which grew from a very small town into this enormous city full of what Engels called the satanic mills of industrial production, or you think of smoky Sheffield, also in northern England, or you think of Birmingham in the Midlands. And if you think of France, you'll think of Lille and its two burgeoning towns around it, Tourcoing and Roubaix, or you think of Saint-Étienne, which was kind of France's Manchester, or in Germany you think of the Rhineland and the Ruhr, and in Italy you think of Turin and Milan, and in Russia you think of the Moscow and St. Petersburg region, or in Spain Barcelona. And indeed, those are sorts of, those are classic cases of industrial concentration where you do have, you know, a really significant mechanization over a very long period of time. And you do have large towns with smoky factories full of workers. But again, and we've underestimated, in fact, the second edition has more about this than the first of what you're reading, you know, the degree of industrial production in the late Russian Empire. To be sure, when I say that that Industrial Revolution is first and foremost an intensification of forms of industry that already existed, if you were a parachutist and you're somehow floating down over the European over Europe from say the middle of the 18th century through the middle of the 19th century, what you would see is that there were still all sorts of industry, a rapid increase of industrial production that is out in the countryside, that's not in factories, that's done in a very traditional way, or rural handicrafts, people producing all sorts of things, you know, still at home. And there's just a marvelous book written by a woman called Maxine Berg, B-E-R-G, who teaches at where does she teach? In the north of England, someplace, it'll come to me in a minute, called The Age of Manufacturer. And she re-examined even the Industrial Revolution and discovered that, for example, the town of Birmingham, which produced all sorts of toys, big toy manufacturers, that you still, even though you had a lot of factories, you still had a lot of the toys are being finished or even produced by women working in the hinterland, that is the the environs of Birmingham, or if you take Sheffield, smoky Sheffield, a grim kind of place in the 19th century where they produced knives and cutlery. You still had a lot of these products being finished by people out in the countryside. Or if you take the north of France, if you think of a town like Reims, R-E-I-M-S, famous for its champagne, if you take Reims, you know, it was a big industrial center, but it wasn't a center of mechanized production until after about 1850. What you had is you have all these people out in the countryside, mostly women, who are doing spinning and weaving and carding and that kind of thing. Or around Nancy, which is a town in the east of France, by 1875, you still had something like 75,000 women who were embroiderers working in the countryside. And rural industry, you know, it intensifies. And then finally, at the end, what you have is this sort of, not at the end, but it depends on where you are, you have this implosion of work into factories. And so by the end of the century, the kind of traditional view that one would have of the Industrial Revolution has really arrived, where factory production, and above all, in the textile industry is the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution, the textile industry, and that you have women who used to work, you know, at home, and are now working in factories as what the British call textile operatives. Or Switzerland. I mean, you think of Switzerland, and you know, as being the famous mercenaries in the early modern period, or the very wealthy bankers, you know, in our own day. But if you think of a town like Zurich, you know, Zurich on the lake. There was all sorts of industry in the uplands of Zurich, that is, you know, up into the hills and up even into the mountains around Zurich of handicraft production. Or Austria, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Austria also, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people working in the textile industry. So the details aren't as important, you know, as the fact that, to be sure, you know, the mines that you read about in Germinal, anyway, which is a great, great read. And the factories that I will describe in a while, or described by Engels, and I couldn't do better than that, you know, are a reality, and they become, you know, the industrial experience. And when you think of, you know, Detroit, Michigan in the 1930s, or Flint, Michigan in the 1930s, or you think about, you know, all the sort of now the Rust Belt of Connecticut, of Torrington, and these places that were once booming industrial towns. You know, that's the kind of classic model, and the American model really is closer to what people used to think what the Industrial Revolution meant in the case of Europe. But that's you know, not a subject for now. But a couple points, you know, along the way. I don't think I'll ever get to my notes, but it doesn't really matter. First of all, and this is another reason why the Industrial Revolution starts in England. You can't have an industrial revolution without an agricultural revolution. And because what the agricultural revolution does is increases the amount of food produced, you know, that's going to feed your sort of burgeoning proletariat, your labor force. And this is a place, you know, all of Europe increases in population. The French population is unique. It stops growing in 1846 and 47. It simply stops, skids to a halt. But everywhere else the population grows, and there are regional differences in France, as there are regional differences everywhere. But the Industrial Revolution depends on the Agricultural Revolution for increase in food supply. This makes possible the increase in urban population, thus also increasing the demand for food. And also, the Agricultural Revolution, particularly, but not just in the case of England, increases capital formation, that you've got this sort of surplus of money, bucks, pounds, pignon, you know, cash that can be invested in industry. And this is precisely what happens. So that's why the Agricultural Revolution is absolutely important. And so these three things, Industrial Revolution, Agricultural Revolution, and the growth of cities are very much tied together. Let me give you an example, which you certainly don't have to remember, but you know, think of Manchester. I described the statistics in there, that they're absolutely, you know, the growth of Manchester is a prodigious, scary thing. And I'll talk more about how rural and urban elites are frightened by the growth of cities, particularly in Germany, but in France and England and in the United States later. What the growth of Manchester does is it really changes the countryside around and helps bring the Agricultural Revolution. What do I mean by that? You find the same thing around Paris, or around Berlin, or around Warsaw. Almost any big city that I can think of is you've got, in response to this urban growth, this big sort of octopus of people and money, of rich people and poor people. I'll talk about some of the rich people next time on Wednesday. You've got an expand for demand for food. And so in that ring immediately around a city like Manchester, you've got a dramatic expansion of people doing what they call truck farming. You know, they're producing, they're specializing in crops for the urban market. Fruit, vegetables, things like that. They specialize because there's people there that are going to pay for and eat what they produce. You know, take the example of Paris, which I'll come back and talk about with great relish someday, that in the suburbs of Paris, a place called, doesn't matter at all, called Montreuil, which is a kind of a grim part of eastern Paris, used to be famous for its cherries and fruits and that kind of thing that they're producing for the urban market. Or wine, if you can imagine wine being produced, what a horrible idea, in the region of Paris. Well, it's Agnières, which is on the Seine River, used to produce wine for this urban market. Then the next big ring around Manchester, you've got the big fish eating the little fish, and so they're more productive, more this commercial agriculture develops, and more productive production. A greater productivity for in response to this urban demand. And on the far distant places, you have people specializing in the production of cattle, that is milk and meat for the market. And of course, the other thing which goes without saying is that in the course of the 19th century, you've got this, you know, amazing development in shipping, because, you know, pretty soon with steel and with refrigeration, and you've got just like now, you've got lamb arriving from New Zealand and things like that. And this is largely in response to the increase of of these large, you know, urban conurbations, that we use the term conurbation to describe cities that grew up so much that they actually, you know, merged together, and all of that. I mean, the American Northeast became sort of a conurbation, and it's very hard to, you're going through New Jersey, to ever see where there aren't cities, because one ends and then the other starts. And that becomes the case in parts of northern England as well. So the term proto-industrialization there is what we mean by the expansion of industrial production along very traditional lines. And what I put in parentheses there, domestic or rural industry, we've already talked about. So this, the first, you've got this expansion of industry in the countryside. And I'll give you one example. Again, I hate to keep taking examples occasionally from France, but because I know that best, but the city of Lyon, which is a big silk producing city. What you have is you've got in the first half of the 19th century, you've got an implosion of work into Lyon, into this working class suburb of Lyon called the Croix-Rousse, it doesn't matter, though it's a neat place. It's a really neat place. And then in the 1850s, the people that own the silk begin to put work back out into the countryside. Why would they do that? Because the women working there or the men working there work for less than people living in the city. So this, again, if you're parachuting down starting about 1750, you're going to see this, you have to imagine, you know, hundreds of thousands of little dots out in the countryside, and even more of them as the Industrial Revolution gets kicking along before you finally have this implosion or movement in and around cities. More about that when I talk about cities. And I'll help explain why European cities are so different than American cities, with the poor living on the outside and the rich living within. And large-scale industrialization has a lot to do with that. Now, having said all of that, let me talk a little bit about, I'll never get to my notes, but this is fun anyway. Let me talk a little bit about women's work. Now, did the Industrial Revolution change women's work? Well, there are continuities in women's work which are extremely important, and ultimately there'll be changes as factory production comes to dominate in many places in industrial Europe. Yet there are certain things that don't change about women's work and women's role in the household. That women remain the head of the family economy. That women, whether they're married or simply, you know, living with people that they've been living with for a short or a long time, run the family economy. And it's true whether they are in rural Switzerland in the uplands of Zurich, working in the textile industry, or whether they are textile operatives in Manchester or someplace like that. The Industrial Revolution does not change other aspects of women's work in that at least well into the 19th century in most parts of industrial work, industrial Europe, women are still working in the countryside, but also major employers of women don't change at all with industrialization. The classic case here too is England, and that is domestic service. If you were going to take England in, say, 1850, the largest three categories of people doing anything are, not in this order, but just about all the same number, would be women working as domestics. Well, let me say just really, yeah, okay, women working as domestics, men worked as domestics too. Say domestic service, say textile operatives, and an important category that I'm going to talk about later and in my theme of it's bitter hard to write the history of remainders, rural agricultural laborers, rural proletarians. And then another category of women's work, again, which one hesitates to evoke, and of course prostitution. And the Industrial Revolution here, it doesn't change that sad aspect of women's work. What it does is increases with urban growth the number of people working as prostitutes in even very, very small towns. The number of prostitutes in Paris or London are simply incalculable. The estimates in Paris go from 20,000 to 100,000. And lots of women who are married become prostitutes pour faire sa fin du mois, to pay off the bills at the end of the month. And so this sad aspect of women's work, people forced into prostitution by want, doesn't really change with industrialization. The numbers simply get bigger and bigger. And of course, one of the results of this isn't the time to discuss this, but there's a sort of panic at the end of the 19th century, you know, about syphilis and about venereal disease and all that. And also, which ironically helps further condemn ordinary people in elite minds, which is a very coincidence, since many of the patrons or many of the clients of prostitutes were middle-class males in no matter what country you're talking about. More about women's work in a while. Now, in the context of factories. Now, here's again the way, history has its history too. And when I grew up, to the extent I ever did, in my as a student, I mean, back when I was thinking about doing a dissertation and becoming an historian and all that stuff, what people studied was, the reason I put it in quote, was working class consciousness. And we were sort of children of of the very late or the 60s or the 70s, and everybody wanted to follow the great English historian E.P. Thompson, who wrote a monumental book called The Making of the English Working Class, and everybody wanted to find the making of class-conscious workers in various places. And everybody wanted to study the crowd, as in the crowd in the French Revolution, my late friend George Roudet's famous book, The Crowd Here or The Crowd There. And the first article I ever published was called The Crowd in the Affaire de Limoges, April 27th, 1848. And now I look back sometimes and think, I mean, who cares? But anyway, in the 1980s, then the move kind of turned away from that, and more people started to study the middle class, more about the middle class folk in the 19th century, and what my friend Peter Gay called the bourgeois century, next time around. But nonetheless, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, and class remains a fundamental concept. If you're going to understand 19th century Europe and 20th century Europe, you have to understand social class, because it was a reality. We live in a country now where people, people like to think there are no classes. Well, don't get me going on the current economic crisis. I can remember people going down to the Ford plants in Ypsilanti in Detroit and trying to get people who worked in those places interested in the war against the war in Vietnam, and getting absolutely nowhere, and hearing arguments that no, in America we don't have classes. Well, that simply isn't true. But anyway, in the 19th century, social class was a real thing, and nobody had a stronger class identity than the middle class. And that's what I'm going to talk about next time. I can hardly wait. What we call, there was a working class, but not everybody saw themselves as workers, as a form of identity as opposed to something else. I mean, people could have multiple identities. When we talk about nationalism, that's an obvious point to make. I mean, people, if you ask people who they are, they might say they're Protestant or they're Jewish or they're Catholic or they're Muslim. Or they might say they're from this extended family, or they're from this region, that they're Bavarian or from Poznan or whatever. But in the 19th century, class identity, the sense of being workers as a class apart, was a reality. I mean, that's just the way it is. And that was worth studying, and people did some very good work on it. And it's kind of come back, too. It's kind of come back. Anyone who's been in Britain, where class identity is so revealed by language. I mean, there isn't any place, including France, or any place else that I know, where a difference in accent are so revealing as to who, not only who you are, where you're from, but who you are in terms of social class. It's really just amazing. It remains true in France and some other places. There was a strangler. There's always these stranglers around in Britain. And there was one guy who was this sort of hardcore killer, bad guy, killing a bunch of people about 15 years ago. And they finally get all these experts on language, and he'd called up, I guess, a radio station, sort of, here I am, come and get me kind of thing. And they had him pegged to where he was within something like 10 miles of where they ended up arresting him, which was in Bradford in the north of England. So language is one of one of the ways that people reveal their class. But in the 19th century, we're talking about workers and how some workers, but not all, began to see themselves as proletarians. And that seems like one of those trendy words, but it meant something to people. A proletarian is somebody dependent on their own labor, usually unskilled or semi-skilled, in order to in order to survive. And there are two aspects to the term proletarianization. One is kind of the objective sense, that you are a laborer. You may be a harvester. You may pick grapes for the wine harvest. You may be carrying around large boxes, which is what I did at Alice Loves Jams and Jellies in Portland, Oregon, or at Kellogg's of Battle Creek, where I also work, totally unskilled. But again, that was not going to be my lifelong identity, because I was able to go on to do something else. But in Europe, you were born into the proletariat. In most cases, if you grew up as a Catholic, you in this part of France, you would have been practicing Catholic. A Catholic guy, a young boy or young girl, young woman, in and around Saint-Étienne or in Lille, the chances were overwhelming that you were going to follow your parents into the mines. You were going to go in the mines. As a matter of fact, I hate giving these French examples, but there's an expression that's really only used there that I've ever heard, where a kid screws up, does something not supposed to. And what they say is, deux semaines sous un bain, which is if you spend 2 weeks, ducking down like this and having to help guide this cart full of coal up and down the railroad tracks, you won't screw up like that again, little boy. The sense of, you were born into the world of work. Now, in America, there was all these kind of literature, the equivalent of Boy's Life, about, remarkable ascents into the social stratosphere, that America was a land of opportunity. Well, America was a land of opportunity, to be sure, and with availability of land, but the cases of social mobility were actually fairly limited, and this was certainly the case in almost all of Europe. You were essentially born into, for most people, into this status. Now, the other thing that happened, and this explains the rise of class consciousness, is that people who suddenly the bottom drops out of their economic life, it's a fairly appropriate analogy for today, who were artisans, who were craftsmen, become really the first. Depending on where we're talking about, it begins really about the turn of the century, that is 1800, slightly before, but mostly afterward, by 1830 in England, and then follows in other countries in many, many places, where artisans and craftsmen are really the first to see themselves as a class apart. Not unskilled workers. Why? I mean, this is pretty obvious. Artisans and craftsmen are educated up to a point. They have a sense of dignity about their trades. They have organizations. They have mutual aid societies, for example, or other, there's a craft guild organization in France called the Compagnonnage. This came from the medieval times when they built the big cathedrals and all of that. They have organization. They have a sense of pride and craft dignity. Now, Karl Marx, who's a pretty smart guy, he got a lot of things wrong, but he got a lot of things right. Karl Marx wrote in the 1830s and 40s about how workers' wages were declining. Well, he was right for artisans. There's no question about it. And artisans are at the forefront of every single social and political movement that you can think of. In the French Revolution, there we go, who stormed the Bastille? It was artisans. 1830 in France, 1848 in Austria, in Berlin, in Paris. It was artisans. Now, why all of a sudden did they get mad? Well, there's really two reasons, two things that happened to artisans that caused their economic situation to go downhill. First of all, the French Revolution, or the effects of the French Revolution, destroy the guilds. Now, anybody can be a tailor or a shoemaker or whatever, a glassmaker. If you learn the skills, there's no one going to say, you can't get in this union. You might not be able to get in this mutual aid society or friendly society, but you can't do the work because the guilds are gone. The French Revolution, banishes the guilds. Free economic, laissez-faire, Adam Smith, et cetera, et cetera. And there are laws against unions. Strikes are not illegal in France, or not legal in France till 1864. The Corporation Acts are reinforced by the fear in Britain of the French Revolution. But what happens is you've got what can be called, Bill Sewell has called it that, a friend of mine in Chicago, the crisis of expansion. You've got all these people now who say, hey, I'm going to be a tailor too. And if you lived in Berlin or someplace in the 1840s, you would hear tailors walking along the street with pushing carts full of clothes that they had made from the beginning to the end of suits being sold for practically nothing. Why? Because there's so many other people making suits as well. And also, mechanized production means that you can buy suits off the rack. And they're getting very little for their suits. They didn't wake up and think, geez, I can't remember how to make a suit. They got these suits, they can make them, and they can't sell them. And their wages are declining. Are they mad? They're furious. Who do they blame? They blame the state, and they blame the bourgeoisie, the middle classes, the middlemen. For example, in the case of tailors, there are a lot of middlemen who've got capital. So what do? You say, look, I'm going to get a bunch of suits made. Now, here are all these tailors. They don't have enough to work. I'm giving you a not a very good example because I don't know a damn thing about being a tailor. But they say, okay, you guys do the sleeves. All of you do the sleeves. You guys do the pants because you can do them all one after another and don't have to worry about doing the rest of it. Then I'll pick up everything that you make. So this is a continuation of rural industry, and then I will sell it in the markets. Into the middle of the 19th century, no, I mean into the World War I, you still had single women in Paris, now chained to their sewing machine, not literally, but they got to pay off the sewing machine after the sewing machine starts before electricity, but after electricity comes along, and they're working by themselves. Not their day isn't cut short anymore by the end of daylight. It's cut short by sheer fatigue and producing these goods for this market. And so these tailors and shoemakers and all of that, they're in every single movement. And they are the ones who first say, hey, you know what? All we workers, we got some stuff in common. And this is amplified by residential patterns, people living in and around where they work, et cetera, et cetera. And mechanization also. I'll give you an example that I do know something about, which is porcelain. Porcelain is one of these products. It's a luxury good. Renoir, the great painter, started out, he was born in Limoges, France in 1841. Renoir, he starts out painting plates. He paints plates. Now along comes this new technological innovation. You know how, if you those model airplanes and stuff like that, and there was little decals that you'd stick on the plane to represent the Spitfire or whatever, American fighters or boats. I'm not such a war guy, so I stopped that pretty quick. Somebody invents one of these things, these decals that can be baked onto high-quality plates between the first and second baking. Porcelain remains a luxury good, and the people that used to paint them are sent to the warehouse where they work for half or a third of what they, not half, but for about a third of what they would make as skilled painters. They didn't wake up one day and say, Jesus, I can't remember how you paint a plate anymore. They said that no one's going to pay them to paint plates except for very special orders. Glass making is the same thing. People that made bottles, that formed bottles, used to be very well paid, and then a machine is invented that comes along and does the same thing. It turns out bottles by the zillions to be filled with wine and whatever. So they're out of luck. Are they mad? They're furious. And pretty soon they start thinking, these unskilled people, we have some of the same grievances. And they begin seeing themselves as a class apart. So class consciousness isn't sort of an invention of lefties from the 1970s like yours truly. It's not at all. I mean, it was a reality. It wasn't for everybody. But I mean, if you read a lot of the literature, especially from London or from anywhere, about the kinds of solidarities that people had because of the social class and the sense that they formed a class apart and were relegated to sort of a permanent proletarian status by forces that they can't control, the state and big money and big capital. Well, people would be a little better off if they're thinking about that now. But anyway, that's that. Having said that, I want to turn in the last 10 minutes to, did I get all that in? Yes. I want to turn to something that complements that, and that is a discussion of industrial discipline. Because one thing is, as workers strike, as workers learn to strike, you know, going on to strike for better working conditions, for more money, for better hours, shorter hours, et cetera, et cetera. One has to imagine, you know, what the world looked like from them. What did they think about things that were happening to them? And one of the things that had happened to them was this sort of 19th century end stage of the Industrial Revolution. That is factory production. Now, if you were an artisan, if you were a tailor, or I keep using the examples, but they're so stuck in my mind, or artisan, a tailor, or shoemaker, you basically worked, you know, when you wanted. You worked in response to, demand for your product. Many of these people were on the move, going from one place to the next. But you worked kind of when you wanted to, or when there was a demand for your product. If you were in domestic industry, and you're a woman working in the hinterland of Zurich, you worked when there was demand for your work, and then you took time off to nurse your child or to take account of the family. See how we were doing, if there was enough to tide through until the next week, you more or less worked on your own. Now, a pottery baron called Josiah Wedgwood, you've probably heard of Wedgwood Pottery, he says, just before 1800, he says he's trying to think about how you make all these workers that he has, how do you make them respond in the very same way? So they don't just kind of get up and wander off or spend time talking or enjoying themselves. How do you get them all to work at his single command? And his dream, his fantasy, was that he wanted a set of workers that responded as fingers on two hands in response to his commands. That's what he wants. And he and his successors create strategies of doing just that. And in doing so, they launched this sort of protracted struggle, which is very revealing about the bigger processes at play in the 19th century. And factories have a lot to do with that. I guess, you know, here too, when I say that with such intensity for my bad experiences working in factories, I once was working in Alice Loves Jams and Jellies, and they'd come to work about, supposed to be there at 6 in the morning after a night I probably shouldn't have had. And the last thing I remember was the guy, he didn't like me because I was a college guy. He said, I always had my Mighty Maize and Blue Michigan shirt on, and he said, listen, idiot, the last, I was on jams and jelly duty, is there was a huge machine, like you have to imagine an enormous accordion. And they'd put all these berries in there, and then the press would squeeze them into jelly, which we would drink or eat and make ourselves absolutely sick. And there was build up a lot of pressure, and the last thing I remember him saying was, listen, idiot, don't leave your finger on that button very long. And as I was trying to figure out, you know, who had beaten who the night before in the American League, the thing blew up. And this enormous tidal wave of boysenberry juice engulfed me, and I was burned. Actually, I was on sick leave for 2 weeks, where I was just down playing basketball and getting paid to do that. And this tidal wave of boysenberries, a forklift with about something like 2,000 jars of apple butter spun out of control, and it was a terrible, terrible mess. But the point of this is that I hated the foreman, and that factory. And as I left, I said, well, too bad for you, foreman. And I didn't say, I take that back. And so anyway, the point of this is that factories become, first of all, a way of maintaining industrial discipline. And that in the first factories in Britain, they were not there because you had these machines that were there immediately. James Watt's steam engine was not used for really about 15 years after it was made. Because there weren't many things they could do. The first factories were there putting together artisans, semi-skilled workers, and unskilled workers as a form of industrial discipline. And when you think, if you see postcards, you know, at the end of the 19th century, really about 1900, the craze for postcards begins in Europe and in the United States too. And now these postcards are extremely expensive if they have people in them, particularly people at work. I mean, they're really, really, and I have all sorts of them from Limoges and the porcelain industry and from the strikes. But if you see these pictures, when workers had them, their pictures taken together, they are always in front of the door. Because why? You had to enter the door or leave the door. The signal was given by the clock and by the bell that called you to work. And if you were late, well, too bad for you. You could be docked or fired. And there are lots more people out there who would like to have those jobs. And so what happens in the 19th century is that the factory, you know, before really its role as a houser of big thundering machines, in many places the factory was first and foremost a way of putting discipline on workers. There's a whole terrible case in Brooklyn, I think in 1912 or something, where 150 or 200 women were burned to death because they had, you know, locked the bosses, had the foreman had locked the door so they couldn't go out, quote unquote, chatter. And so what they begin to do in the middle of the 19th century is have rules, regulations for work, what you can do, you can't talk, and what you can't do, what you must do. And if you were a porcelain worker and something blew up in the oven, well, that was docked from your salary. And so in order to, you know, to watch over these workers, they bring in the foreman. Four people, too, because there was a strike in Limoges because a woman, was very religious, and she made the workers kneel down on the ground and pray on the stone, with her knees on the stone before work started. No separation of church and work there. And so they bring in foremen who are going to enforce these to see if you're a good worker or if you're a bad worker. Now, workers resent this very much. How did workers view the bosses, for example? In the 1820s and 1830s, they tended to, you know, you're still working in smaller units of production in most places in Europe if you're in a factory. And you see you got an issue with the boss. The boss is somebody who might give you a little extra on Christmas or something like that. The boss is somebody you knew, and there was a sense of, well, you know, you're not doing me right now. This isn't right, and I'm going to leave till you get it together to do better by me. The boss is a presence. He's there all the time, as my boss in Dennis Uniform Manufacturing Company, also in Portland, Oregon. He was there all the time. By the time the foremen start coming in, if the foreman is representing the boss, and the foreman is somebody who's brought in from the outside or promoted, often unjustly, from within. And the foreman replaces the boss as the one who's hitting on the young female workers. What they call in French the droit de cuissage. That's rather crude. The right of hitting on scoring with putting oneself in a power relationship with a female employee. So the foreman begins to represent the boss. And the boss now, during strikes, the language of workers during strikes is, you know, the boss, he's a lech, he's a drunk, he eats too much, he doesn't care whether live or die. He's still somebody you see kind of walking through and all that. You don't like him that much, but you know, he's still a presence. The strikes at the end of the 19th century are very, very different. The boss often he's a very distant person. He's sending telegrams from London or sending telegrams from Frankfurt to his foreman, demanding this or that. In the case of a strike in Limoges, France, the owner of the factory, who was an American called David Avillon, Haviland, as in Haviland porcelain, one point actually demands that the U.S. Embassy send in the U.S. Marines as if that was possible, in order to put an end to this disturbance, this disorder in his factory. He has become, or she, a symbol of capitalism, protected by the state and protected by the army. This is how workers, not all workers, but in many cases, view the boss. Industrial discipline has been imposed by these rules, these regulations, these foremen. And if you don't like it, too bad. You can't. Women workers are no longer allowed to nurse their children, to bring their children in, or to go out and nurse them. They are forced to eat, you know, inside the factory. And if you're, that's why the tuberculosis rates are just enormous, particularly in mining and in factories. I mean, all the kind of, you'll see this in Germinal. It's really kind of an amazing book. So this is the view of workers of their bosses tells you something about this long process, very uneven and not everywhere, but still there, that explain this massive kind of movements of strikes that you found in all sorts of countries. Northern Italy, in Barcelona, in Moscow. In Moscow, in 1917, this huge strikes would be terribly important in 1917 in Moscow. And then something else happens. And I'm going to end with this because it's in a minor way, amazing tale about a colleague, a brilliant woman I know called Michelle Perrault, something she wrote in the late 1970s that it just still tells you so much about our time. In the beginning of the 20th century, an American engineer called Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, comes up. Remember, this is the time the Olympics have started up again. You measure how fast people can run the 100, or how far they can throw the shot put. You're measuring things. The car races have begun. The Paris-Roubaix bicycle race, which was a bloody spectacle with bikes careening out of control all the time, and these working class heroes getting just mangled, in part through each other's manipulations of trying to knock them off. But you're measuring things. And so Taylor comes up with this way of measuring units of production, the ultimate in industrial discipline. You are on the assembly line, they will count the number of units you can do of jars of apple butter that you can turn out. And if you're not turning out enough, see ya, we'll get somebody else. There are a lot of people want that job, we'll see ya. That's why their wages stay down, because there are a lot of people want those jobs because of the growth. Now, and he becomes the darling of the French car manufacturers, just the end of Ford. He becomes the darling. He is a hot item. He would be on People magazine if they did have one, because he comes and tells them how they can get more effort out of their tired, fatigued workers by counting them. And it just like that all the way. And Michelle Perrault, when she wrote a brilliant article and edited a book I did a long time ago, their article was called The Three Ages of Industrial Discipline. And she had an amazing phrase for the late 1970s. This was before, thank God, cell phones. And it was before computers, personal computers, and all of that. There were computers, but they weren't personal computers. She said that in this post-industrial age, where you've got the Rust Belt, and you've got factories being torn down outside Detroit and in Flint, in Torrington, and Waterbury, and places like that, and almost any Pittsburgh, and almost anywhere you could name that was the heart of the American industrial experience, she predicted in 1978 that what would replace Taylorism would be the computer, that the computer will measure in your cubicles your performance. And she said in the end, the foreman would be replaced by the quiet violence of the computer. Kind of amazing. See you on Wednesday.